We had essentially predictable operation based on the development and advancement work. There was only one relatively major fix-it item in the plant, where one column had to be changed from a what amounted to a knockdown column for a heavies to a type of quenching tower, which incidentally I had installed in my own reactor at the bench scale level, and somehow didn't get translated to the first plant blueprint. But there was some more trouble in the startup of the plant due to unexpected concentrations of byproducts and some polymer formation here and there. But in general, the plant did in fact go into trouble-free operation within a year of its startup, and I think this is a pretty interesting illustration of what can be done to really shorten commercialization times when you're willing to take some risks. And I spent a year in the plant feeling columns and looking at temperature indicators and sampling tops and bottoms and doing material balances, and it was an experience I wouldn't trade.
In terms of the catalyst, was it in-house catalyst then?
Entirely. We later licensed its production, but it was an in-house creation entirely.
Because now all of a sudden you have a bigger demand for this catalyst.
Yes.
Right? So
yeah.
You have to.
Yeah. Well, and that's another aspect of it that we should not pass. The management made what I thought, and a lot of people thought, was the management made what a few of us thought was an extremely wise decision on how to commercialize, which really sort of went against the grain of chemical industry tradition. Early on, with the help of Morrow and Hughes and Chapman, who was not only patent counsel but a leading negotiator for licensing agreements, that if we had something this good, that it would be a classic mistake to try and use this environmentally, economically advantageous technology to produce acrylonitrile for the world. People will always look for sources of alternate supply. In addition, there were the existing acrylonitrile manufacturers using the old HCN acetylene process, and it would have been, by hindsight, counterproductive for us to try to put them out of business. So the decision to license was wisely made after we had brought our first plant into operation and its commercial viability was proven. And at that point, the old technologies based on acetylene and HCN and ethylene oxide and HCN all folded and ceased operation within 5 years, and the major producers from the DuPonts and the Monsantos and the Carbides on licensed this Ohio technology.
Okay.
So without question, they made the right decision, and the licensing incomes, which vastly exceeded the operating income from our own plant, proved them right.
Did the Lima plant continue, though? I mean,
I understand the Lima plant is now closed. I'm not sure of that. If it's not, it's probably close to being closed. When Ohio and BP merged, a new facility at Green Lake, Texas, was put into operation, and that is now, as I understand it, operated by contract by Sterling Chemical or something like that. And it was a 600 million pound facility, which at that time was the largest acrylo plant that had ever been constructed.
I guess as a native of Ohio, just as an aside, I have an awful time when I'm there not seeing any Ohio stations anymore, but only BP.
Yeah, I look wistfully back on it myself. Ohio is a unique organization, and off the record, I'm not sure that the best interests of the stockholders or the country were served by that merger. The old research center is a ghost of his former self and probably is closed by now, or is almost.
I'll have to go by there the next time I'm in Cleveland.
I think it's still operating with a skeleton.
Well, what do you do for an encore after you've been at Sohio only a few years and here you are responsible for this major innovation?
Well, that was difficult. I had a choice of continuing in the chemical and the catalyst area, which maybe was a mistake not to do. I continue and always have had a high interest in catalytic reactions and still do when I get the opportunity to research in catalyst chemistry. And we talked about some earlier that I'm currently starting to work in. At that time, the question of what to do with all this acrylonitrile, and so we launched a polymer group to see if we could find any novel uses for acrylonitrile outside the uses that were already commercial and where we would not have to compete with our customers. And this polymer group grew rather rapidly, again under Veach. It had a leader for a while whose name I don't immediately remember, who was very competent but apparently interested in other areas, so he went to another section of the company. And I had begun to try to become a homegrown polymer chemist, so with some fear I switched fields to polymer chemistry and was asked by Veach to lead the polymer efforts at Sohio. And at that time, the barrier properties of high nitrile films were just beginning to be recognized. And Sohio had, at the time I took the helm of polymers, had developed by a casting process a polyacrylonitrile film, which was a wonderful film, and I probably still may find uses when it's it went through the Delaney problem with acrylonitrile being a carcinogenic material, but that's now largely resolved because if you can, if you want to, you can get the monomer contents of those films so low that you really don't have extractables. So as a food container, why nitrile containing resins of some formulations are acceptable and even for beverages, I believe the FDA clearance has now been reached. Anyhow, we concluded that, or I concluded that they were right about the nitrile film and barrier type packaging material opportunities, but the fatal flaw was that you had to cast it, and that's a very expensive way to make a film. So some research had already been started on making a thermoplastic version of polyacrylonitrile, and as you probably know, PAN itself, because of the high attraction between the nitrile dipoles, is not a thermoplastic. It cross-links and decomposes before it diffuses for conversion. But work done by a lady by the name of June Duke and two gentlemen by the name of Drs. Frank Vincent and Bill Donovan and Ralph Isley had shown that it's of course possible to make nitrile polymers with acrylate comonomers, a name known to us from other earlier work, that could with some difficulty be fused. And the question was how much of the barrier property of acrylonitrile remained if you put enough monomer in it to internally plasticize it. And about that time, calling back on the work of Norman Grassi, who did some of the first diphtheridine ring decomposition work, and one of our own very bright young chemists, Dr. Larry Ball, found that there were certain critical impurities which, if removed from nitrile copolymers, greatly improved their resistance to decomposition. So with that, we were able to develop a copolymer of methyl acrylate and acrylonitrile, which had a fine combination of barrier properties. It was an average barrier to water, but it was a superb barrier to CO2 and oxygen and nitrogen and some other things. The only problem was it was brittle, and we could blow mold it in a blow molding machine, but it was still brittle. It did respond to orientation, and later we and Monsanto and some others found a way to stretch blow that cured the brittleness problem, but that technology was not advanced at that time. Only Phillips's Orbet process for polypropylene was known. We didn't have access to a Phillips machine. So again, calling on the skills of the group, I directed the research towards developing a reinforcing agent that would impart impact resistance. So borrowing from ABS technology, the group prepared an acrylonitrile butadiene rubber with enough acrylonitrile in it that its elasticity was not harmed, but which also had the same refractive index as the base resin which we grafted onto it. And thus was born what is called Barrex resin, which the market people imaginatively named it. And this turned out to be the item which is now a commercial article for high barrier packaging of foods and beverages. Well, not beverages, but a lot of processed foods, meats, industrial products, pharmaceuticals especially, which require oxygen and CO2 protection. Interestingly, we instantly recognized the opportunity in carbonated beverage bottles, and we approached some beverage companies, Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola and ginger ale and a few others, and Pepsi-Cola was the first to jump. And we asked them for a list of properties that they would like in a plastic barrier bottle. And, of course, the answer came back, well, it should look as clear as glass, and it should bounce like rubber, and it must hold 75 PSI internal pressure and be a barrier to CO2 and everything like that. And it turned out that Barrex did all of that. The first carbonated beverage bottles that were field tested in the United States were Barrex, and that was 25 years ago. And here is one of those bottles. It's cloudy. Oh. It's cloudy today because the rubber stabilizers have long since been used up by the light, but. At one time, that bottle was clear as glass and bounced off of concrete floors and things like that.
It's brittle now. Yeah.
Probably, yeah. In those days, well, you could slam a file drawer on it and it wouldn't crack.
And it says in new plastic bottles.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah,
right on. They're making a point of it in there.
Yeah, that bottle is 25 years old, and. The only thing it didn't have, and I told him it didn't, was sufficient thermal and creep resistance. And if you put it in a hot car trunk in the summertime, it will expand. But it does keep the material flavorful and everything else for 2 years. Hmm. What we did do, of course, unknowingly, was pave the way for PET, because it turns out that most carbonated beverages are consumed within 10 days of being bottled. And so if you put them on the shelf, there's no problem with PET. It's not a good barrier, but it's good enough. And it happened at the time that this series of experiments was completed and the market study was completed, the market study showed that a carbonated beverage bottle would be a howling, in plastic, would be a howling success. But it would have to be less expensive, it would have to have better heat resistance. It also happened at that time that the 3 billion pound PET capacity in the United States was only 50% utilized, and the PET industry was looking hungrily for something else to do with their material. So it didn't take DuPont and the others very long to discover how to orient a PET bottle, and so that's why we're where we are today.
So this would have been 69, you said 25 years?
69. Well, actually, this would, yes, that's about right. It was in the late 60s and early 70s, right? The work on that began in about 63, and I took over the plastic research at SOHIO in 62. So that was the follow-on, and then later I got into work on other polymers. We did work on unique synthesis of unsaturated polyesters by using olefin oxides directly in place of ethylene glycol, so you didn't have water of reaction and that sort of thing. And,
had you, before 1977, had you ever thought of leaving SOHIO?
Not really, and I probably would still be there today but for two things. A friend of mine had dropped my name without my knowledge to a executive recruiting firm, and I had some concern about how the I guess I'd better be careful how I phrase this, about how the opportunities for upper management positions would be in a corporate acquisition, which in the end amounted to a takeover. So when the offer came, why, instead of not listening to it, I chose to listen.
One other thing before we reach that 1977 point. You listed starting in 1964 as somebody who had an influence on your career or your life was Dr. Henry Gray.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could.
Well, Henry David Gray is a fascinating person. He just died on September 3rd at the age of 86 this year. But I met him quite by. I guess the word accident is not the right word. Maybe it was by someone's intent from somewhere. In Hartford, Connecticut, where I spent a lot of time with a consulting firm that I had hired, or the SOHIO had hired, to do work on nitriles. And I was really raised in a believing religious family, and that continues. And Dr. Gray was at once a great scholar and a great friend, and I was in need of a little guidance on career matters at the time, and somehow we just sort of clicked, but he earned my respect the instant I met him. And we had become fast friends over the years, and I have some interest, a lot of interest, I should say, in things religious and theological. I don't flaunt it too much, but it's a matter of deep interest to me, and he was until his death probably one of the four or five leading congregational scholars in the world. He was invited to be the keynote speaker at the 350th congregational anniversary at Westminster Cathedral in England, for which he had written a sermon, which his son David had to give because Dr. Gray had fallen and broken his hip just 2 weeks prior to his anticipated departure. But I remain almost an adopted member of their family, and I consider it an absolute miracle and privilege to have met a man like that.
Where was he located?
He was pastor of the Old South Congregational Church in Hartford, Connecticut, which is the 10th oldest church in the United States. And he was their 13th minister. And even among churches, that one is unusual for the tenure of its ministers, and each tenure is around 35 years.
That is unusual.
He is quite a guy. I could go on for hours about him.
Again, I'm quoting from something you wrote in 1974. Acrylonitrile containing polymers have grown from being a laboratory curiosity to one of the most prominent and useful types of polymers over the past 40 years. And the growth has occurred stepwise.
Mm-hmm.
Synthetic rubber, fiber, molding, resin applications, and so on.
And packaging. You should distinguish that from molding resins.
Okay.
Because molding resins, to most people, denote ABS resins and SAN resins, and they're a chapter of their own. ABS, I believe, is now a larger consumer of acrylonitrile than fibers. And then there's the chemical area, which is largely polyacrylamide, but that has extensive use in gelling agents, thickening agents, drilling muds, and so on. So it has become quite an interesting material. And now it is the basis of a new form of polymer type called the dendritic polymer, or the dendrite, which is a cluster polymer grown much like, it looks sort of like a coral, if you will, which grows outward by the addition of Michael-type additions to alpha-beta unsaturates, which can be derived from acrylonitrile, which is anhydrogenated to the corresponding amine, which is reacted with more acrylonitrile and grows outward.
I see.
And it's a rather fascinating new form of polymer. Another one which is interesting is the so-called flat polymer, which has recently been published on by George Whitesides at Harvard.
Okay.
And that's the carpet type, if you will.
Okay.
So polymer chemistry is doing interesting things, still some of it based on acrylonitrile.
But isn't it true that polymer chemistry has never really gotten the recognition it should have in chemistry departments?
I agree with that totally. And one has to recognize, of course, what one means by polymer. If we mean synthetic polymers, synthetic polymer methods, synthetic polymer characterization techniques, and polymer physics, Yes, I think that's probably right. It's just now coming into its own. Polymer chemistry, I think, probably finally got legitimized somewhere in the 60s, although very more of those schools like Akron and Brooklyn Poly, then Brooklyn Poly, now New York, were pioneers in the field. And one of the early ones was, of course, the Case Center at Cleveland. Early on.
Okay.
But if you look more broadly at polymers and quickly get to proteins and sugars and naturally occurring polymers, why, of course, polymer chemistry has been around forever. And I think the thing that makes it all the more significant now is that the methods for characterization of any polymer, organic or inorganic or natural or synthetic, are beginning to get the overview treatment that they should have had. But it certainly is true that in the early days, education in polymer chemistry was achieved primarily in the industrial sector and not in the academic sector. And the academicians were slow, if not reticent, to realize it.
But even today, isn't it true that a lot of polymer work is done in engineering departments?
Oh, absolutely.
Schools,
absolutely. And that's given the course that polymer science, if you will, has had to to follow in the last 25 or 30 years, it's very understandable. The development of polymer technology, development of polymer science has been technology directed and therefore commercially and industrially influenced, and I guess it's natural that the development of polymer science in the universities would follow what is sort of a retro path in coming back through the engineering schools, who are the first ones to respond to industrial needs for fabrication and processing, and finally leaping, as is necessary in some cases, the academic fence between engineering and science. Now, there are some schools that manage that with a lot more skill than others. Now, I probably should not go further there.